Wrestling.
And this is the Portland WrestleCast. I'm Jim Valley. I hope you enjoyed the Portland episode of Tales from the Territories. I enjoyed it. You know, that was a fairly eclectic group of people. I don't think any of their times in Portland overlapped. Mike Jones, Luke, Princess Victoria, they were all late 70s, early 80s, while the grappler Lynn Denton was there starting in 1987. But all things considered, I thought they blended really well. And I know some people criticized having Mike Masters and Princess Victoria because they weren't in Portland very long. But Masters had some great stories about Buddy Rose, which he first told on this show a few years ago. And I know that the producers used this show because they called me and told me. And that makes me very happy, to be honest, especially because Mike Masters passed away and he got one last moment on television. So that makes me happy. As far as everything else, I had heard the urinating story before. I'd never heard the killed story. And that clip of Piper with the beer bottle, that is from Vancouver television. He did it in Portland too. He probably did it in other territories. But since the beer bottle he showed is from Vancouver, I'm wondering if the kilt incident happened in Vancouver. I don't know. I wasn't there. Either way, I'm sure it happened. By the way, if you haven't already, be sure to check out the archives. There are a lot of great tales from the Portland Territory. And that is essentially what I've been doing with this show since 2018. You know, I was sick for about a year, so there's about 3 years worth of stories. And I really think that this show kind of has always done its own Tales from the Territories. I set up what was happening, and then I give you an interview from somebody who was there. And I think today's show is also sort of a complimentary piece to what we saw on Tales from the Territories. Today, we talk with Al Getz, who is a noted wrestling historian and author of Charting the Territories. Be sure to go to chartingtheterritories.com. And today, we are going to chart, thanks to Al, Portland, back in 1979. That means Buddy Rose, Piper and Portland, the Sheepherders, Adrian Adonis, and a number of people you may not associate with the territory. And 1979 is probably the peak of my fandom because I was around 10 years old at the time and enthralled by Roddy Piper. And as my friend Howard Baum says, nothing is cooler than when you're 10 years old. We'll compare my memories to Al's charting, see how it lines up. And I think we're both going to learn some things. It's a very fun interview. But before we do that, let's refresh your memory. 1979. Buddy Rose and Ed Wiskowski ruled the Northwest until they teamed up with fellow bad guys, Roddy Piper and Killer Tim Brooks, known as Bad News Brooks in Portland, for a four-man elimination team match, sort of like Survivor Series. In the match, the heels had eliminated Hector Guerrero and George Wells. Ron Starr had Killer Brooks covered when Ed Wiskowski came off the top rope with his patented Harley Race style diving headbutt. Wiskowski misses Ron Starr, who got out of the way, hits Brooks. Starr covers, eliminates Brooks, and then chaos ensues. There's finger pointing. Then the heels start pushing each other, then punching each other. And somewhere in the melee, Rose and Wiskowski injure Brooks and send him out of the territory for a month or so. Roddy Piper becomes a good guy, and the rest is history.
We got a little problem here in the Northwest. My partner, Ed Wiskowski, had a mishap in the family, and he had to fly home because his dad is in bad shape in a hospital in St. Joe, Missouri. So Ed Wiskowski's not going to be here for a while. Now, I took Mantell as my partner, and we are going to wrestle you, Starr and Adonis, for those belts. And another thing, Roddy Piper, you got too big a mouth. There's not enough room in the Northwest for you and I, and only one of us is going to stay. And you say that you want to wrestle me? Well, Ed Wiskowski will not be here Tuesday night, so I do not want to wrestle Roddy Piper. Because for some reason, something might happen, such as, you know, this is my interview, boy. This is my interview. You don't have no business
Needless
up here.
To say, Roddy Piper.
Wiskowski's not here. Brooks is not here. Well, let's see who has enough guts. Sign a contract. I'll wrestle you Tuesday right here in Portland. Who's got enough guts? I'll do it.
Well, I'm not going to do it.
Let's go.
You'll do it. I don't care who you're wrestling. For me, Tuesday. Piper? You know what happened to Brooks? The same thing is going to happen to you. I'll wrestle you. I'm not afraid. I crippled Ventura, Johnny Boyd, Jay Youngblood, the list goes on, Hector Guerrero, and you're going to be crippled too. I don't need nobody in my corner. You haven't got Killer Brooks. I haven't got Ed Wiskowski, so it'll be just you and I, because I'm not afraid. I've got guts. You see my guts right there. I got guts, and I'm going in that ring, and I'm going to show you, Piper. You will never see that battle royal yourself.
As Buddy Rose and I mentioned, Adrian Adonis and Ron Starr were the top baby faces before Piper in the early to mid part of 1979. Now, listen to this interview. Let me explain first. In this era, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders were super popular and considered to be sort of Americana sex symbols. And there's this poster of three women of larger body mass index, shall we say, wearing Dallas-style cheerleader outfits in an obvious parody at the time. Now, if you listen to this interview, with a couple of exceptions, this is a heel interview. But either way, the fans in Portland loved it. Here's Ron Starr, and this is Adrian Adonis.
Are perfectly capable of carrying our belts up here by ourselves, and we like Rose, Wiskowski, and whoever to notice this. You know, everybody seen the match last week. Everybody thinks that Rose and Wiskowski are responsible. What really did happen? Wiskowski, like an amateur, goes to the well too many times. My partner Starr had the man covered. He moved, he went off. We started the beef. We didn't get in this business to hurt professional wrestlers. We got in the business to beat them with wrestling strength and agility. But let's face it, Brooks, what goes around comes around, and you got it. Yeah. And there's more to come, ladies and gentlemen. Because like I said, we don't need no wheelbarrow. We're just going to put them on each one of our arms and around our waist. You know, Frank, tonight I've got a match against this rowdy Roddy Piper. Well, let me tell you something, Mr. Piper. Regardless to the outcome of this match, whether it's a win, a loss, a draw, whether we get rained out or whatever happens, I'm still going to chase you until I get that title match. Now, Frank, you know, maybe I've been painting a bad picture about Roddy Piper's and Tim Brooks's girlfriends. Well, you know, we had a couple of pictures sent to us and had them blown up here. And I'm going to show you a picture of Sweaty Betty, of Juicy Lucy, and a little friend of theirs. Now, I want you to take a real look. I want you to get a good close shot right here. And I want you to see exactly what these so-called professional men are running around with. Here's Miss Sweaty Betty, Juicy Lucy holding Tim Brooks' newborn son here in her arms. Right here, you can take a good look at it. Now, let me tell you something, Brooks. You and Piper, Rose, Rosowski, any of you, it makes no difference. We got the belts. We're here to defend them anytime. And one more thing, Frank. You know, there was a town here this week that a couple of bikers decided to jump in the ring. Well, let me tell you something, fellas. We don't know who you're coming after when you come in that ring. And as far as Adrian and myself are concerned, the first pair of eyes we see, we're going to knock them out. So please, stay out of the rings. Leave the fighting to us. We're here. We've got the belts, and we'll defend them anytime. Right, I just want to make a little correction here. I don't mean to, you know, be stepping in. But just this picture right here is a picture of little Roddy when he was young. You see, he started off, his uncle brought him to the ring as a little pig, but he got too big, and he decided to try out for the part of Arnold Ziffel on Green Acres, but he couldn't make it because he had too many pimples on his face, so they canned him right away. Ladies and gentlemen, now you all know the truth about Sweaty Betty and the rest of them. So, Roddy Piper, we're going to let you get out of here early tonight so you can go home to Sweaty Betty and the rest of her crew.
Now, in this episode, we talk about Rip Rogers. And I want to make something clear just in case it's not. I think Rip Rogers in his prime, a lot of talent and potential. And I think that in Portland, Rip Rogers looked like a main event talent. And I think that if he'd stayed in the NWA, instead of spending his time in outlaw promotions like ICW that worked against established territories at the time, I don't think that did him any favors. I also think that the clean-shaven Rogers in Portland look like a star compared to the opening match look of the dark beard, bleach blonde hair, and pink outfit for Cheap Heat. But I think that either way, the talent was absolutely there, and he should have made bigger money. I don't want to make it sound like I'm disrespecting him. It's just the opposite. I think he should have done better. And I think if he stayed in Portland longer, he would have. But he has already tied himself to the Poffo family and ICW.
Cheapbirders are challenging this team, that team. We're not afraid of you, but we don't have to wrestle you to prove ourselves. Our contract is completely open. Just sign your name, anybody, and we'll wrestle you. We're not afraid of nobody. Isn't that right, Rip?
That's right, brother. As a matter of fact, we've only got a little bit of time to talk because we've been overloaded with millions of letters from beautiful girls trying to go out with Buddy and myself. Take a look at Buddy right now. I don't know if you people ever really taken a look at Playboy Buddy Rose, a man with a ridiculous amount of financial security, starting with the head man. The face of Robert Redford, a little bit of Clark Gable, and a lot of John Travolta, with a 30-inch bull neck attached by sloping trapezius muscles, which is a sign of raw power. And girls, what lifeguard shoulders on this man! Cannonball deltoid! If you can get a shot of this big arm close up, you'll see that he's got a baseball bicep followed by a sexy horseshoe tricep. Look at these armor-plated pectoralis majors and minors with serratus magnus and intercostals on this man. A wasp firm waist.
Turn around.
Look at this tears, heart-shaped teardrop gluteus maximus that drives the girls wild. And it's just another reason why there's a million girls after Playboy Buddy Rose. To top it off, diamond-shaped calves, tree trunk thighs, money, girls, you've got it all. We're not afraid of anybody.
You know what's funny about this interview is that Rose is pretty thin for Buddy Rose. He probably got thinner in 1981, if you know what I mean. But in this interview, he's probably pretty close, if not 217 pounds. Maybe within 5 or 10 pounds of it. Either way, let's chart this territory. 1979 with Al Getz. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hello, I'm Tom Peterson. In our furniture store, we have an outstanding Colonial buy. You save $150 when you buy this 7-piece living room group for only $698. Imagine these times of rising prices to be able to buy a 7-piece Colonial grouping like this at prices we don't think you can beat. The sofa and love seat are covered in stain-resistant Herculon fabric and trimmed in pine for the true Colonial touch. You also get three tables, cocktail table, hex end table, and square end table, plus two lamps. Now, if you don't need the entire group, you can buy any piece at these low, low prices. The beautiful Colonial sofa is only $299. The matching Colonial love seat is just $250. The occasional tables, your choice, $67 each. And the table lamps, only $49 each. Now, that's Tom Peterson. It's our furniture store.
So joining us now from Charting the Territories is Al Getz. And you and I, as I mentioned, Al, met at Cauliflower Alley for the first time face-to-face.
Yeah, that was the first time I had the pleasure of seeing you in person and shaking your hand. Of course, very familiar with your work and your knowledge over the years. So it was great to meet you in person. And actually, I remember at that time we had talked about doing something for the podcast. And I think the original idea was to talk about Danny Hodge when he went to Portland in the 1960s. But instead, we're going to talk about a fun time in Portland and a time I know you've already covered probably more than once on your podcast, because it's one of the most fascinating years because it's loaded with talent. But we're going to talk about 1979 in Portland. And you were a fan watching the TV at that time, right?
This is probably what hooked me. I mean, I had started watching 77, 78, I think. But when Piper came around, that's when it just totally hooked me. I had other interests up until that point, but when Piper turned babyface, it was all wrestling all the time. So it's probably his fault why we're here talking right now.
It's funny you mention that, because I grew up in New York and was watching the WWF in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, and probably the time my fandom grew was around the time when Piper came there as well. So we have a common link in that Roddy Piper has made us wrestling fans for life. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't know.
Well, and it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine who was a fan growing up in New York where you were. And of course, we're going to talk about Buddy Rose, who was the big villain to Piper's babyface and a legend in Portland that people will always remember. And of course, Rose fought Backlund in a pretty successful round around the Northeast. And my friend goes, yeah, I didn't really like him because he looked like pretty boy Larry Sharp. And I went, you know, he's not wrong. He's not.
Yeah, no, and Sharp, of course, had been there first. So to a fan that watched Sharp, they probably didn't view Buddy Rose the same light that a fan in Portland or a fan in the AWA a few years later did.
Yeah, it's all perspective.
Yeah.
So where are we starting? First of all, actually, How do you curate all of this knowledge?
Well, I guess we'll talk a little bit about what charting the territories is. I'm a former longtime wrestling fan, but also independent wrestling manager, as well as a few other things. In my real life, I was an actuary for many years. So I have a unique combination of a wrestling background and a statistical background. And the idea behind charting the territories was to take all the territories and come up with some basic statistics, what I like to call back of the baseball card stats. I mean, we know how many times Bruno sold out Madison Square Garden. We know how many times Ric Flair held the world heavyweight title, but we don't have statistics for the mid-carders, the prelim wrestlers. You know, we can't figure out what their batting average was compared to a Flair or a Bruno or a Hogan. So I basically developed a statistic called the spot rating, and it stands for statistical position over time, but it basically measures a wrestler's spot on the cards, with the idea being if a wrestler was always in the main events of a territory, then he was more important to that territory than someone who was in the mid cards or in the preliminary bout. So we basically came up with a way to assign a number to that. And it's basically a number between 0 and 1. And the higher the spot rating, the higher up the cards we are. So of course, in Portland in 1979, you would expect Roddy Piper and Buddy Rose to probably be the top two guys. And it turns out that they pretty much are. And so the other thing I do with charting the territories, because so many territories don't have a Jim Valley or a Mike Rogers or a Barry Rose in Florida or the guys that do the Mid-Atlantic Gateway, there aren't those historians still around that compiled all the angles and house show records and this and that. So I'm basically trying to capture lost territories. And by presenting this data, we don't necessarily need to know what the angles were on TV. I can look at the house shows and figure out which matches happened most often and make the assumption that that was probably what the biggest feuds were. So in this case, I've sort of compiled my statistics for Pacific Northwest in 1979, and we're going to compare that to your firsthand knowledge of the territory to see if I was correct.
All right, then, where do we start?
Let's start with the main eventers. And these were the wrestlers who more often than not were on the main events of house shows. And as I mentioned earlier, two of the top main eventers were, of course, Buddy Rose and Roddy Piper. Rose was a heel, and Piper, as you mentioned, turned babyface, I think it was around April or May, and then ended up feuding with Buddy for the rest of the year. But the other main eventers were Bad News Brooks, and of course, wrestling fans not familiar with Portland probably know him better as Killer Tim Brooks, but here, for some reason, they called him Bad News Brooks. We also have Ron Starr, who is here as a babyface. He often teamed with Adrian Adonis, but he also had a little singles feud with Roddy Piper right before Piper turned babyface. We also have Rick Martel, who came towards the end of the year and got a huge push as a babyface. I think one of the last cards in December, he won a tournament to get a title shot at Harley Race in January of 1980. And then the other main eventers were Butch Miller and Luke Williams. Now, Jim, were they called the sheep herders or the Kiwis at this time?
They were the Kiwi sheep herders.
The Kiwi sheep herders.
Yeah, they were primarily the sheep herders, though.
Okay. They had come in from Stampede. They had wrestled in Stampede over the summer, and they were still Nick Carter and Sweet William. But when they came here, they were Butch and Luke. Of course, the sheep herders that we all have come to know and love. So those are the main eventers. And I think anyone watching the TV at the time probably agrees. I know at the beginning of the year, Bad News Brooks had a big feud with Jonathan Boyd. But Boyd actually, according to my statistics, was considered an upper mid-carder because he leaves the territory during the year. And when that happens, oftentimes wrestlers will be moved slightly down the cards and they're putting over guys, newcomers on that are just starting out. So Boyd started the year as a main eventer, but was moved down the cards a little bit. So he's considered an upper mid-carder, as are Stan Stasiak, Ed Wiskowski, Adrian Adonis, Sam Oliver Bass, who of course was Ron Bass, Dutch Savage, and Rip Rogers. And Dutch is really interesting because of course Dutch is the mainstay hometown legend for what, you know, maybe a decade at this point in time. But he's used very interestingly. In Portland, he's always kept very strong and often in main events. But in a lot of the other towns, he's just working in the prelim match. He's just sort of there to, you know, keep you know, stay around and not, you know, but he's not necessarily part of the important matches or the important angles. So when you factor that in, he's in sometimes in a main event program, and sometimes he's just wrestling a prelim, or he's brought in to be a special referee for the main event. He ends up settling in as a mid-carder, but that's a pretty impressive crew of mid-carders. You have the future Colonel De Beers. You have the former WWWF world champion, Stan Stasiak. You have the very underrated Adrian Adonis. And then you have Rip Rogers, who gets a surprisingly strong push for what's still pretty early in his career. So I know he teamed up with Buddy Rose. Do you have any memories of seeing Rip in action? And did he look like he fit in the spot they put him in?
Oh, he looked like $1 million. If you turn on YouTube and look at Portland at this time and look at a clean-shaven, young Rip Rogers in shape, I thought that guy was going to be like an Austin Idol or something. Instead, he gets the dark-colored beard, and I just thought his body was always in great shape, but his presentation and look left a lot to be desired once he left Portland. I had Rip on this show, and I think I asked him, I go, do you think it was smart? Because he had to leave because the Pothos called him back to ICW to work. So he had to leave. But I asked him, I go, would your career have gone a different, maybe even better path had you stayed with Buddy Rose? And he denied that. He didn't think that was the case at all. But I think that the Rip Rogers in Portland looks like a top of the card guy, where Rip Rogers with the beard and the pink and everything looks like an opening match guy. Not to berate his skill. The skill is still there. I'm just saying optics are important.
Absolutely. And perhaps in a territory where many of the wrestlers weren't, you know, there weren't necessarily all these gigantic heavyweights. Someone like Rip Rogers, who's a smaller guy, but in Portland, you can't tell that he's smaller than everyone else. And with his physique, it really, you know, especially you know, as a teammate of Buddy Rose, again, we all love Buddy, and he's one of the greatest workers of all time. But, you know, to a fan who's just looking at, you know, to see these big, strong men, Rip Rogers in Portland really stands out compared to the rest of these guys who are either, you know, have dad bods. I think of, you know, probably Killer Brooks and Jonathan Boyd at this time, or probably very, you know, strong looking, but not, you know, cut.
Yeah.
And then when you bring someone like Rip Rogers in, it really stands out. Oh my God, this guy's in really good shape. And he looks to be as big as most of these other guys on my TV here in Portland. So, you know, there might be something to that.
Yeah, I thought the Rip Rogers, you know, it's funny, here in 1979, a lot of people came through Portland, as I saw on my TV and in the magazines, Jimmy Snuka, Jesse Ventura, Adrian Adonis. There are some you see that go on to other greener pastures, you expect. And there are others, like, I thought Ron Starr was going to be a guy that I was going to see on my TV and in the magazines for a long time. And that just didn't happen.
And a lot of people thought that too. From what I understand, a lot of people at the time really thought Ron Starr was going to be an even bigger star. Of course, you know, he did have some very good runs on the West Coast. He was the NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champion a couple of times. One was a very brief run in 1976. And then the other one was in 1980 that ended up with him suing Leroy McGurk in Oklahoma. So it could be one of those things that might have been backstage politics that sort of torpedoed Starr's career, because that was 1980. That was, you know, a year after he was here. and he, you know, probably was still on the way up. So perhaps the suing Leroy McGuirk was not a wise move for the career of an up-and-coming professional wrestler.
It pretty much banished him to Puerto Rico for the most part.
Yeah, Puerto Rico, or then...
And outlaw promotions.
Yeah, Southeastern, where he had that feud with Cactus Jack. And I love in Cactus Jack's book, he's talking about his feud with his first feud was being with Ron Starr. I guess it was Continental by this point. And Fuller told the two that the angle was going to be that they were fighting over a woman. And Cactus is like, look at me and look at Ron Starr. We are literally two of the ugliest wrestlers on the face of the earth. No one is going to believe that we're fighting over that a woman, you know, is choosing between both of us because we're so, you know, desirable. I got a kick.
That is funny.
That from
it's true.
Cactus's book. But there's, you know, you mentioned so many guys come and go. And that's the great thing about Portland in 1979 is lower on the cards, there's a few names like, whoa, I had no idea this guy was there. And guys who went on to have very good careers years later, and guys who, you know, similar to Rip Rogers, were wrestlers who made a career out of being professional wrestlers, but were never the top tier superstars. And guys like George Wells, Johnny Mantell, Gene Lewis, who for some reason was used in Portland as Gene Kelly. Hopefully he didn't do any dancing prior to the matches. Sal Martino. Now, do you recall Sal Martino?
I recall Sal Martino. Yeah.
Who would your listeners perhaps better know him as?
He is better known as Salvatore Bellomo of
Salvatore Bellomo. Yeah.
WWF and ECW fame.
Yeah. So he's one of a couple of people in this crew that also works for ECW. Cause, I'm not sure if both of the Sheep Herders did, but I think Butch certainly did.
You know, I don't recall if both of them, I don't even remember Butch being there, but if you say so.
I think they worked when ECW started running in Florida. I think they used
them. Oh, that would make sense because they live
down there.
Because they live in Florida.
So we have a couple of ECW vets in Portland over, you know, almost 15 years earlier, which is wild. We also, for about a month, you had Tully Blanchard come in.
I have no recollection of Tully Blanchard.
He's just there. Yeah, he's just there for 5 weeks. They really don't do anything with him. They don't do anything with Hector Guerrero except for one match where he teamed with Andre. And the way they portray it in the newspapers, it's literally the world's largest wrestler against one of the smaller wrestlers teaming up with Hector Guerrero and Andre. You also have King Parsons before he was an Iceman. And I'll ask you this. I remember him best as Iceman King Parsons. When you hear that, is his name Iceman Parsons and his nickname is King? Or is his name King Parsons and his nickname is Iceman? What were your thoughts on that?
My thought was that his first name is King.
Correct, and that actually is his real first name. And his real name is King Parsons Jr. He's the second generation King.
Yeah, he was just sort of a mid-card guy, win some, lose some. But everybody liked him. He was all the fans liked him.
I could see him being very popular, maybe especially compared to George Wells. I wonder who the fans.
Oh, geez. George Wells was so boring. Gosh.
Okay,
boring.
So there you go. Whereas Parsons had a little pep in his step.
He kind of, you know, he didn't come out to like music or didn't really dance or, you know, kind of have the Iceman mannerisms that he would adapt later in Texas. But, you know, he was just a pretty straightforward baby face. But still, I think all the fans really liked him. I think, did he team with Rocky Johnson? So that was kind of a feather, I think, in his cap, too.
Yeah, that would certainly help a young guy get over to team with Rocky. And then one other baby face who's in the mid-cards was Lanny Holiday.
Right.
Of course, that is Lanny Poffo. And there's a funny thing that happens when Lanny finishes up. It's late February 1979. Lanny had been full-time for a few months, but his last week there, his father, Angelo Poffo, comes in for maybe a week.
I did not know that.
He just works house shows, and they both leave together. And in my head, I envision that Angelo literally came to pick up his son and drive him home.
Probably.
Because from here, yeah, because from here they go back to Tennessee and they form ICW. They had kind of sort of been working with the guys in Tennessee, but I believe in the summer of 79 is when ICW first becomes a real actual outlaw promotion. So yeah, but it's just so funny. You picture Lanny, you know, sitting outside the arena afterwards and his father drives up like he's picking him up from school and Lanny gets in the car and, you know, and they drive from Oregon all the way back to Tennessee.
Pure speculation on my part, but knowing Angelo's propensity for saving a penny, my guess is he wrestled so it would help pay for the move.
Yep. That's one of the great things about the territories is, if you want to take a vacation and you pick up a booking, it now becomes a tax write-off. I was looking, there was a wrestler who's primarily known for wrestling for big time wrestling in Detroit for the Sheik. His name was Ben Justice. And at one point, he randomly worked one or two shows in Central States. And then a couple of days later, randomly worked in, I think, Amarillo. And it made no sense to me as to why he was doing that until I started researching Arizona. And it turns out he was driving down to Arizona to start there full time. So he literally, as he's driving from, you know, Detroit all the way to Arizona, he makes a couple of stops along the way and picks up a couple of bookings to get some money and again, perhaps to make the travel tax deductible, which was really smart. Of course, we've heard the stories about wrestlers getting booked in Florida when they take a vacation down there so that they can write off the vacation. But that was just the great thing about these territories. So yeah, Angelo, and we all know Angelo would love to save a buck. He actually literally called himself the Miser as one of his gimmicks in ICW. And then you also have a rookie, Matt Bourne, and another second-generation star, Barry Orton, shows up in prelims for maybe a month or two.
Yeah, I don't recall him winning many matches.
Yeah, he's probably, you know, guys like him and King Parsons and Hector Guerrero are probably relegated to the 10-minute time limit draws.
Lots of time-minute draws. Lots and lots of them.
You know, that's a thing that is most associated with Portland, but a lot of other promotions would do it with what we call captain's matches. Let's say the main event of a card is going to be a tag team match. Well, what they sometimes do is pick one wrestler from each team to have what's billed as a 10-minute or a 15-minute preliminary bout. And if the babyface doesn't win that match, they usually go to a time limit draw. And I think in a way that the bookers and promoters are trying to educate fans that matches, that the main events will go longer, that it takes more than 10 minutes to wear down an opponent enough to pin him. So when you only have 10 minutes, it's hard to get, you know, do enough damage to an opponent to beat him. And this way it sort of prepares the fans for those main events to often, you know, go longer than 10 minutes.
I remember 2 out of 3 falls matches used to drive me crazy because I knew who was going to win the second fall. And I'm just like, we're just filling time. That's all we're doing. We're just filling time. Hurry up. Get going. Bye.
And every now and then they'd have someone win 2 falls straight. But of course, the overwhelming majority of the time, it goes to a third fall. They also, every now and then, one of those falls will be very, very short, like a few minutes.
Right.
But again, most of the time, they're not. They do little things like that just frequently enough to put doubt in some fans' minds that there's not a set formula they always repeat. But of course, you, as a 10-year-old watching, you cracked the code. I know John McAdam always talks about how when he watched the WWF in the late 70s and early 80s, the booking of the tag team division was so predictable because every new team that came in would win the titles. Every new heel team that came in would win the titles from Martel and Gurria or whoever it was, and then they would have a few months feud before Gurria and Martel won it back. So, yeah, a lot of times when we really follow it, we can figure out what's going to happen, but hopefully most of the fans in those days did not. And you you mentioned to me you went to some shows in Washington State around this time.
Yeah, we would always go to WF West High School in Chehalis, Washington. That was...
I didn't want to say the name of the town because I didn't know how to pronounce it. That's one of the things I've learned about Washington State.
Yes.
Is some of the towns are not pronounced the way you think. I was actually in Seattle and Olympia earlier this year, and someone mentioned Puyallup.
Puyallup.
Puyallup. And I had no idea what they were talking about until I remembered there's a town spelled P-U-Y-A-L-L-U-P, but it's pronounced like it's P-E-W-Y-A-L-L-U-P.
Why wouldn't it be?
I learned the same thing when I started covering Leroy McGurk's territory. A lot of the Louisiana towns, because of the Cajun influence, are not pronounced like they're spelled. So my podcast during the territories, the first few months we did it, all of the feedback I got was from people telling me I mangled the names of the towns. But you talked about Washington State. We don't have a lot of results from Washington compared to Oregon. And one of the things I would love to do when I go back to Washington State is to go to the state archives, because they have the records from the Athletic Commission. I was actually, when I was there in the fall, I looked through them for Dean Silverstone's superstar promotion in 73, 74, and 75. But they have house show reports for all the shows they ran. So you know all the towns they ran, what the attendance was, what the gate was, and which wrestlers were booked on the card. So I would love to go back and add more shows from Washington State to my records. But one of the things we do have is we have some attendance figures from Seattle. They ran, I believe, about every other week they would run Seattle. And we have attendance figures for 21 cards. So the average attendance in Seattle in 1979 was 1,621.
I would have guessed more.
Yeah, it's so hard to know. One of the things that's so frustrating about the territories is we don't have good attendance records for many territories at many times. So it's hard to, know what good numbers and bad numbers are. But I'll go through the three biggest houses in Seattle during the year. Two of them involved Andre the Giant. Andre came in, I believe, in March for 2 weeks. And while they normally ran Seattle every other week, they actually ran it 2 weeks in a row, probably so they could get Andre there twice. On March 21st, they had Andre versus Bad News Brooks. And then they did a rematch a week later between the two in a dog collar match. And the first match on March 21st drew 2,391. And the rematch, which was the dog collar match, drew 2,436. They actually increased attendance for the rematch between the two. But the biggest house in Seattle, no surprise, was for Roddy Piper versus Buddy Rose in a steel cage match on Christmas Day. And they drew 3,051 fans. So almost double the average attendance for Piper and Rose. Granted, probably the fact that the show was on Christmas Day helped the attendance a good bit. And in fact, in Seattle, I think that was a tradition that it didn't matter what their normal day of the week was, they would run a show on Christmas Day. So that probably had something to do with the attendance, but I think the Piper and Rose steel cage match had a lot to do with it as well. And that was the fourth match between Piper and Rose in Seattle. Piper turned in May, so they had a couple of matches early in May, but then Piper leaves for a few months, comes back later in the year, and they did two more matches in Seattle, building to the steel cage match. And of course, in Portland, they're still building to the blow-off of the feud there, because that would involve a hair versus hair match. And that was one of the big storylines in 1979, was Buddy Rose winning the hair of a couple of different wrestlers.
Right. He started with Steve Pardee, who was like the lowest guy on the totem pole. And then, or maybe it was, then I think he shaved Mike Hennessy, and then King Parsons and Chris Adams,
Red Bastien. So he shaved a number of heads before and then Piper started shaving heads. I think we covered this in another episode of the podcast. And then Piper shaved one sheep herder's head, and then he shaved Butch's head, and then finally he got Buddy Rose, and they drew like 6,000 in the Expo Center.
Wow, talk about a long build-in. The Pardee thing is funny because I believe it was Pardee's second or third match in the territory, and actually it might have even been his second or third match as a pro, but if I read somewhere, I believe that he was on TV wrestling against Rip Rogers, and Pardee was presented as, you know, just another preliminary guy, nothing special, and I think Rogers and Buddy Rose end up getting frustrated and walking out or getting disqualified.
Right.
So Pardee wins.
Right.
And then I guess is so, you know, so full of pride that he decides to accept Buddy Rose's offer.
Steve Pardee from Sacramento. Let's give a welcome to Steve. And along with him, one of the veterans of the Ring Wars that you all know, Stan the Man Stasiak. You can do a little work here with Steve. Steve, first of all, welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank. First of all, I've heard a lot about the Northwest, and I'm still new to this wrestling business, and I'm here really personally to challenge Playboy Buddy Rose, for the reason being, I've heard last week that he's been challenging people to what you call a Playboy match, or what he called a Playboy match. Now, I don't want to lose my hair. I'm not sure Rose don't either. But if Rose really wants to back up what he says, he will take up that challenge with me. Now, I think I've proved to people here just tonight that I could take care of myself by defeating both Rip Rogers and Playboy Buddy Rose. Now, I got Buddy Rose. I want him really bad. And if he wants to back up what he says, like I say, I'm all for it. And like I said earlier, I don't want to lose my hair because it means my hair means just as much as it does to Buddy Rose.
Well, Stan, the young man comes in willing to, Rose is the one popped off last week and said he put up his hair when he called a Playboy match. We've got someone here accepting him.
Well, I got to say one thing. I think this boy's got a lot of guts. And, you know, I talked to him in the dressing room, and he realizes how tough Buddy Rose is. I know how tough he is, and I told him how tough he was. But after seeing him tonight, I had to listen to this boy, this young man. The way he throws those drop kicks and the way he handled himself, there is no doubt in my mind that he can defeat Buddy Rose, and that would be a great upset. And I think that this is a great star of the future right here. And I have to back him up. I will give you all the pointers you need, Steve. And also, I will make sure that there is no outside interference. I will personally see to it that Rogers does not come near that ring. And I'm sure that this young man will defeat Buddy Rose.
Thank you very much, Stan Stasiak. Steve Pardee.
Go get Don Owens. Tell Don Owens to come up here. Steve Pardee, you shook the rope and I lost 2 straight falls. You shook the ropes on me. I see your plan. Well, I heard that you challenged me to my Playboy match where you put your hair on the line. Don Owens, come here.
I got Don Owens out of the office.
Okay. I heard the little kid come up here. He wants to put his hair on the line. One of us has got to shave their head. You tell Steve Pardee that I will wrestle him next Saturday night in a Playboy match. Loser has to shave his head. There has to be a winner. One condition, it's not going to be put on television just in case I might lose.
All right, but I'm going to guarantee you that if you go through this match, somebody's going to get their head shaved out there in the ring, and no messing around, or there's going to be a big fine put on both of you. Is that understood?
That's right. When I get through with Steve Pardee, he's going to be as bald as you are, and I'm not going to do it on television, but this is going to be easy. This is going to be easy. I'm not going to lose my hair. It's going to be like...
Adrian Adonis has joined us.
Adrian Adonis just mentioned to me in the dressing room that he thinks it's time we got rid of you, and he'd on Tuesday the 18th, we're having a special match. He said he'd be willing to meet you in a match to where you had to leave town if you got beat.
Hey, Frank, I don't think anybody has ever beat Buddy Rose too straight. Now you know how it feels. It's on the other side of the fence, Rose. Down, you're scared. You're almost terrified. You're trembling. You're going to be leaving town on September 18th. Tuesday, September 18th, Rose. Your bag.
Also, ladies and gentlemen, about the hair match next Saturday, Don mentioned to me earlier that it's a money-back guarantee if the hair doesn't get shaved in the ring.
I guarantee Steve Pardee is going to lose his hair. This is going to be like a night off. I'm going to beat him very easily. You think I'm going to lose? You're crazy. How does he think he can walk right into Portland his first night and challenge a main eventer, a former United States heavyweight champion, to a hair match? I can't believe it. And then the goal of Adrian Adonis to come up here for a match 3 days later after the hair match in a loser league town. Now I hear you say he bought a home, he's bought some land, his wife is pregnant, he's here to stay. Well, Adrian Adonis, after I beat your partner, Steve Pardee, and when he's completely bald, then I'm going to beat you on the 18th, and you can leave, and you won't even be able to live in your home. You won't be able to have you. And your wife is pregnant. I can't believe it. I'm going to upset their whole family. I'm going to upset everybody here, and I'm not going to lose next Saturday, because Pardee, you've gone too far the first night.
It's bait to get you to buy tickets for next Saturday to give you hope.
That's always the way it is, and right. Portland was always fascinating because they had the house shows. Well, it was a combination TV, live TV taping slash house show on Saturday night where they would show the first few matches live on TV and then run angles or promos to try and get you to literally leave your house on a Saturday night to come to the sports arena to see what happens. And then about once a month, maybe even a little more frequently than that, they would run Portland again on Tuesdays. I think in 1979, I've got 20 house shows in Portland on a Tuesday.
The Tuesday special. Yep, the Tuesday specials. Those were always like some bonus. The feud is extra hot, so we've got to have this match or that match or whatever. But Portland is really good in this era at episodic television. And I think oftentimes the episodic nature is better sometimes now at this era than what we have now as far as those breadcrumbs that get you to tune in from week to week.
Yeah, it's episodic, but at the same time, they didn't have set endpoints like TV does today. Like everything AEW is doing is designed to all climax at the same time at their next pay-per-view.
That's true.
In Portland and in other territories, they would run an angle on TV, and then as they bring the feud to the house shows, if it draws well, they'll do an inconclusive finish to build to a rematch. And if not, maybe they'll just have the babyface win and try something else. So there is storytelling, but at the same time, I think before you hit the record button today, we were talking about jazz and improv. In many ways, that's what they're doing. They're throwing stuff at the wall, and if it sticks, they're going to go with it, and they're going to keep playing that beat. But if it doesn't work, they will just do a quick little interlude and then change tempo altogether and try something else. But it also, in many territories, and it might not be the case in Portland, but this gives them the flexibility that if a feud draws well in some towns but not others, they can almost create different narratives. You know, if you follow the WWWF, Bruno or Backlund or even Hogan, at any point in time, there's three or four monster heels trying to chase Bruno down. And so they'll run an angle on TV. Let's say it's Ernie Ladd. And then they'll run Bruno versus Ernie Ladd in all the major cities. And if it does well in Madison Square Garden, they'll do a non-clean finish to build to a rematch. But if it doesn't draw well in Boston, Bruno might win clean the first time out, and they'll have another opponent ready to go for the following month. So this allows them to tell different stories in different towns. And because they have the localized promos, where, you know, Ernie can come on TV and say, after what you did to me last month in the Garden, I'm coming back and this time it's going to be a no DQ, blah, 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 blah. Whereas in Boston, they might see, you know, George Steele do a promo, you know, because now he's going to be the one coming after Bruno. But in Portland, I think the TV, for the most part, aired throughout the territory. Aside from Portland and Seattle, the towns we've got good records for, we mentioned Portland was sometimes on Tuesdays. Another town they ran at least 15 times on a Tuesday was Roseburg, Oregon. Wednesdays was typically Seattle every other week. Thursdays was Salem every week. Salem, Oregon on Thursdays, and Fridays was Eugene, Oregon, pretty much every week. I think they took off for the summer and they would run towns close to Eugene. And then, of course, they fill up the rest of the schedule with what we call spot towns in places like Coos Bay, Albany, North Bend, Lebanon. In Washington, they ran some small towns, Elma, Lacey, Port Orchard. And surprisingly, I believe they only ran Tacoma once during the year, which is a large city in the state of Washington. Do you know why? Was Tacoma considered too close to Seattle to run separately?
That's a great question. I don't know. Maybe people just decided to go to Seattle.
Because the ad for the show in Tacoma literally says first time back in Tacoma in years, because I know Dean Silverstone ran it regularly. So
maybe there wasn't a venue big enough. I don't know. I mean,
or maybe there was one that was either too big or it was too small. They couldn't find one that was that fit Goldilocks just right.
Right. I mean, because the arena that they're running in Seattle, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's like 5,000-6,000 people. So that's what they're doing in Seattle. I'm kind of surprised they only did 1,500 in that arena, I would have guessed.
Yeah, and if they're averaging 1,600, then you probably realize if they don't have something smaller in Tacoma, it's not worth running.
Right.
And then the other, you know, one of the things I do at Charting the Territories is I use population and demographic data to try and identify towns we might be missing. And hopefully in my travels, I will then go to those towns or to the state and try and find microfilm records. So based on my research, the towns most likely to have had regular wrestling at the time would have been Corvallis and Medford, Oregon.
Yeah, Corvallis.
Corvallis. And then in Washington, I know Longview had been a regular stop for years. We have access to the newspaper from Longview, and there aren't any ads for shows in 1979. So they might not have been running it, or for whatever reason, they might not have been running ads. And then, of course, the Tri-Cities region of Kennewick, Pasco, and Richland was one that Silverstone had run fairly regularly and did decently. And of course, one of his best towns was Yakima. So I don't know if...
I remember it running occasionally in Yakima, but not very often.
Okay.
Because they would run down the cities each and every week about where they were going to be. So I'm used.
And that's the other thing. If we have access to those old tapes, you know, for all the weeks, we can find those small little spot towns that they ran. Because I know Dean did the same thing. And I think San Francisco, Big Time Wrestling, did the same thing. They used to have the board where they would tell you where they were going to be, which is interesting because one of the reasons territories didn't always do that is because you don't want fans to know that they're running all these other towns. You want them to believe that the house show in your local town, Friday night, is the most important thing going on. And when you find out that these wrestlers are wrestling every single night, it can take the bloom off the rose. It also maybe helps people realize, you know, well, boxers can't fight more than a few times a year because it takes so much out of them. Maybe this wrestling isn't on the up and up if they're literally wrestling 6-7 nights a week.
Right, exactly. I'm trying to think. One town I know they wrestled in that was smaller near where I lived was Oakville, Washington.
Oakville.
I saw one or two cards in Oakville.
Okay, so I can add that to the list. The challenge with if they're only running it once or twice a year, to look through a year's worth of newspaper microfilm to maybe find those is tough. So the idea is to go to the state archives
sure.
and look through the athletic commission records, and we say, okay, they ran this town on, you know, July 5th. Now I know specifically when to look, you know, at the microfilm for those specific, you know, for a week before that show to hopefully find the ad. So that's one of the things I do. And I mostly focus on Leroy and the Gurks territory in Oklahoma and Louisiana. But I've done a little bit of research in Portland as well. And, of course, I did a lot in 1979. So what do you think the biggest feud was? And this is basically the match that happened the most on the house shows, or at least the most in a short period of time.
You know, this is... Well, I mean, the obvious answer is Rose and Piper. However,
this answer is usually correct.
Yeah, but it didn't happen until later in the year, but when it happened, it happened. So, yeah, you got to go with Rose and Piper.
Cuz when Piper first turns, they have a little run for a few weeks, and then I think in Portland they did a coal miner's glove match on July 10th, which was Piper's last match there for at least a couple of months. So something must have happened during the coal miner's glove match where perhaps they did an injury angle with Piper to explain him being away. But then he comes back, and then they build to a series of matches in December. And in most of the towns, they did a cage match. We talked about how they did a cage match in Seattle on Christmas Day. They also did one in Portland on December 27th. They did one in Eugene on December 28th. And in Salem, the big stipulation match was what they called a logger match, which most fans probably know as a lumberjack match.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the cage match. I think there's a picture that circulates online every now and then of Buddy Rose trying to climb out of the cage and Roddy Piper pulling down Rose's trunks and exposing his bare butt, which was a spot they did every time in that cage match. I think every...
They did that spot many times in many places over the years. They always tended to do it with the most out of shape guys.
Right.
I imagine being a female fan and thinking, look at all these good looking wrestlers, and the only ass you get to see is Buddy Rose's.
Lucky them.
So that was the biggest feud based on my statistics. Actually, in addition to the spot rating, I created another statistic that I call FLW, and it stands for feud length in weeks. And it basically, much like the statistic called WAR in baseball, attempts to quantify how many wins a player contributed to his team's performance by all the things he did, behind the plate and in the field. FLW is kind of meant to approximate how long the feud would have lasted if all the matches happened sequentially. Like, as we mentioned, Piper and Rose had two sort of mini feuds over the course of the year. But if you lined up all those matches together, it was about 4.5 weeks worth of matches. So their FLW score was a 4.56. The next biggest feud was a tag team feud, and this was the Sheep Herders, Butch and Luke, feuding with Dutch Savage and Stan Stasiak. And the matches in most of those cases was a title match. They traded the tag team titles back and forth a few times during 1979. And then the third biggest feud was Bad News Brooks versus Jonathan Boyd. And in those matches, the blow-off was the dog collar match. Of course, Jonathan Boyd first came there as part of the Kangaroos with Norman Frederick Charles III. But in early 1979, Boyd was a babyface feuding with Bad News, a.k.a. Killer Brooks. So they would have dog collar matches as the blow-offs. And since Boyd was leaving, he lost those matches. It's a rare situation where the heel comes out as the clear victor of a feud.
I saw that match. They did that match in Chehalis. That was a really bloody match. And as I recall, it ended when Brooks, they're outside the ring, and they take Boyd's head, put it next to the ring post, and wrapped the chain all the way around his neck a couple of times. So he's basically stuck there with his head, you know, chained to the ring post while he's just bleeding a gusher. I mean, you want to talk about a conclusive babyface loss. I remember just leaving going, how could he lose that badly?
Yeah, that was rare for the time. You know, usually, and even when they did things like that, they would disqualify the heel. So at the very least, right, babyface gets his hand raised. But that's to build to a rematch. In this case, since Boyd was leaving, they, you know, really used it to put over Brooks strong. And of course, it ends up Brooks doesn't stay too much longer. And after he leaves is when Piper turns babyface and Brooks comes back for a few months in the summer. And he ends up teaming with Piper against Rose and I'm guessing Rip Rogers. So it's interesting that they put him over so strongly as a heel, but he ends up not staying too much longer.
Well, he was kind of the catalyst for the Piper feud and everybody turning. They had done a Survivor Series elimination match. It was Rose and Wiskowski, who were they were buddies, and then Piper and Brooks, they were buddies. And I've said this before, Brooks was sort of like the cowboy Bob Orton role. And then they fought Ron Starr, Adrian Adonis, Hector Guerrero, and maybe George Wells, someone like that. And the heels started winning, beating Guerrero, beating Wells, getting too cocky. And then Brooks was covered, and Ed Wiskowski came off the top rope with a diving headbutt. And I think it was Starr got out of the way. They hit Brooks and pinned Brooks, and all mayhem proceeded after that. And then Rose and Wiskowski injured Brooks, and he was out of the territory for, like you said, a couple of weeks.
Okay, so it was an injury angle,
yeah,
to get him out of there.
And when he came back, he was a babyface.
Right, and he is only in for a few weeks. And also, Jesse Ventura came in for a few weeks.
Came back,
as well,
yeah,
in the spring or the summer. I forget when. But the other top feuds were both involved Buddy Rose, and one was against Stan Stasiak, and one was against Dutch Savage. And I'm going to ask you, Jim, can you guess what the major stipulation match was in the Buddy Rose versus Dutch Savage feud?
Oh, it's Coal Miner's Glove.
Exactly.
If it's Dutch Savage, it's a Coal Miner's Glove.
Right. So, yeah, that, and it's interesting that all these feuds all have a different stipulation as being important. Rose and Piper was the cage match. The Sheep Herders versus Dutch and Stan was just mostly for the tag team titles. Brooks versus Boyd was the dog collar match. Buddy Rose and Stan Stasiak, if they weren't having matches for the singles title, they were having tape fist matches. And then Rose and Savage were having the Coal Miner's Glove matches. So we have five different feuds, all with their own unique stipulation matches that generally served as the blow-off, which is smart because, you know, you can't give the Coal Miner's Glove match to anyone but Dutch. So it's just neat that they all have their own unique sort of stipulation.
Well, and Stan Stasiak would tape his fists for that heart punch.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
So then you have an eye for an eye when the other person has it. There was, in one of the tag team matches that I saw, it must have been Stan Stasiak and Dutch against the Sheep Herders or something like that. For some reason, Stan didn't wear his tape. Maybe they told him not to, or it was outlawed, or he said he wouldn't. For some reason, his hand was not taped up. So it's the third fall. Dutch is just getting his clock cleaned, and Stan Stasiak goes back to the dressing room. Where's Stan going? Stan comes back with a towel wrapped around his hand. And he's hiding it behind his back as if we all can't see it. And then, of course, he tags into the match finally after Dutch crawls across the ring valiantly. He jumps in the ring, takes off the towel, and, of course, there's the tape fist ready to go to town on the bad guys. So that probably happened all the way around the horn.
A lot, yeah. Like Lawler pulling down the strap when, right, when the fist gets taped, you know you're in trouble.
Yeah, so that's why they had the, you know, Buddy. That's what always happened with Stan in pretty much every territory. People would complain about the tape. That was standard procedure.
Yeah, in some territories they had wrestlers with loaded boots. One wrestler, Dr. X, Jim Osborne, in Leroy McGurk's territory, would load his boot. And then they had another masked wrestler, the Great Bolo, who's Al Lovelock, who would stick a foreign object under his mask and then headbutt his opponent. Now, of course, if you really think about that, it probably hurts both guys, but whatever. But they would sometimes build to matches where the opponent would get to wear headgear or some sort of protective, you know, headgear, so that the foreign object headbutt wouldn't do any damage.
Yeah, we had, in 78, the Iron Sheik was here doing the loaded boot. We had the Grappler doing the loaded boot. God, we had all the gimmicks here in Portland. The Assassin, yeah, with Dave Sierra as the Assassin with the loaded headbutt. We had all the cheap heat gimmicks here in Portland.
It's funny because so many fans think their territory was the place where something was invented. And more often than not, that was something that was done in every territory. I know people talk about when Boris Malenko would have his false teeth stomped on. They'd fall out and the babyface would stomp on them. He did that everywhere.
Right.
Or the cigar burning angles, with the manager would light up a cigar, you know, and eventually they'd burn the babyface. That happened everywhere. That's the fun thing about wrestling is if something works, it's going to get copied.
Well, probably one of the most famous things that ever happened in Portland was Buddy Rose in 1980 threw the Pacific Northwest title off the Fremont Bridge in Portland, Oregon. And Buddy freely admits he copied that from Paul Jones in Florida. So,
right. Paul Jones had done that. Of course, years later, Dick Slater did it. Heck, they even did it in the WWF in the Attitude Era,
yeah,
with Austin, right?
Yeah, and then the Intercontinental Belt. So, yeah, there's nothing new under the sun.
There's nothing new under the sun, but we love it. So Jim, you were watching as a 10-year-old in 1979. As a 10-year-old, did you cheer for the good guys and boo the bad guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I was the same way at first. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I grew up watching WWF. I watched other things on TV, but it wasn't until Randy Savage, came to the WWF that I started getting into the quote-unquote cool heels. And Savage, I was at Madison Square Garden for his house show debut at the Garden. And, I mean, it was just electric. And I don't even think he had been on TV yet, or if so, that, you know, maybe once. But his match early in the card, he was just so different than everything else we'd been used to seeing in the WWF, which was much more slower paced.
Punch and kick,
Stud and Andre, and I love Junkyard Dog, but especially at that point in time, there wasn't much, you know, meat to the bone, or there was too much meat and not enough bone. But when you see Savage in his just absolute prime as just a lunatic, it really made me, you know, start to appreciate wrestlers for their abilities and not just the he's a good guy or a bad guy.
I liked two heels. I remember I liked Ken Patera around this time, 1980 or so, because he looked like a million bucks. He was just beating everybody up. He was just sort of like, you know, almost like a pre-Road Warriors thing. So dominant, you just get on the winning team. And then I also liked heel Hulk Hogan. And then I liked early babyface Hulk Hogan, but probably maybe by the end of 85, early 86, I was kind of done with, because the act had changed so dramatically that he just seemed like a shill and not authentic anymore, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think over time, I think Hogan as the babyface in WWF, in later years, he didn't do anything new or different. He just did more of the things that pure wrestling fans don't like and less of the things that we do. I think even from the beginning as a babyface, he did a lot of the same shtick. He just didn't do it as often. And then in later years, he realized he could get away with literally doing as little as possible. And who can blame him? It's the Kevin Nash formula.
Right.
You know, do the least you can to make the most amount of money you can. I certainly don't fault anyone for being smart in that way. But of course, as a fan, especially, you know, the thing with Hogan is, you know, when you see him wrestling in Japan, he can do all these things. He just chooses not to do it in the U.S. So, you know, as a somewhat educated or smarter fan, you're a little frustrated because you kind of want to see him do more, even though you understand why he doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So those were kind of the two heels that I liked at the time. But in Portland, no, I was Team Babyface all the way.
Okay. Now, one of the wrestlers we didn't get to talk a lot about, the reason I want to bring him up is because I was just talking about him with someone else, because he is on the Hall of Fame ballot as part of a tag team, and that's Adrian Adonis. Of course, he's on the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame ballot for his team with Jesse Ventura. Here, he was teaming up with Ron Starr. You mentioned earlier that you thought Ron was going to be a huge star. What did Adonis look like, and how is his work in Portland in 79?
You know, he was the same work. You know, he and Adonis were both so smooth in the ring as far as just very graceful, the rolling, the explosiveness. You know, they were, you know, fairly identical as far as I thought their work goes. You know, later, Roddy Piper and Rick Martel teamed up, and you had the smoothness of Rick Martel with the brawling and explosiveness of Roddy Piper. So they're different, but they complement each other. Starr and Adonis were very similar, but complemented each other. Adrian was not in great shape, but he was smaller than probably most people remember him on the national stage, closer to, you know, the AWA, earlier AWA Adrian. But
yeah, so sometimes when you have a team where two guys are too similar, it doesn't work. You mentioned Adonis and Starr. Of course, the team of Adonis and Ventura were very different. Adonis was the workhorse, was very smooth in the ring, and Ventura looked like a million bucks and talked like, you know, a couple of million bucks. So they both have, qualities that the other one didn't. They really worked well together, similar to the team you mentioned of Martel and Piper. And that's probably why Adonis and Ventura are on the Hall of Fame ballot. And Adonis and Ron Starr as a team was just sort of a thing that they did briefly.
And the other thing is Adrian Adonis, you know, sort of like a lot of heels when they turn babyface, he didn't really change the interview style. He gave it to Rose like a heel would, instead of, you know, oh shucks, apple pie, doing it for mom and the flag and what have you. You know, he was, you know, almost the same way. I'm using it in exaggeration, but the way Stone Cold would still talk like a heel about The Rock or Mr. McMahon, Adrian Adonis, in his way, was still very heelish when he would talk about what he was going to do to Buddy Rose.
Yeah, that doesn't always work. Sometimes when a heel turns babyface, they can get away with doing the old shtick because that was, you know, their personality, and that someone like Piper is perfect for that. But sometimes it doesn't work. But, you know, it's interesting to me to see Adonis and Piper here at the same time, because, of course, me growing up in the Northeast, I remember the big match between Piper and Adonis at WrestleMania 3. And so I looked through the house show records to see if Adonis and Piper, they didn't necessarily feud with one another, but they did have several matches against one another. But I also learned they did feud the prior year in Southern California.
Right. They were good friends from California. Yeah.
I think Adonis at that point was still wrestling as Keith Frank.
Right. He had been in Portland, Adonis, in the earlier 70s as Keith Franks. And then he just shows up as a babyface, Adrian Adonis. And I guess I've never seen him before because I wasn't watching in 77 or whenever it was. But
yeah,
fans just seem to go, he's Adrian Adonis.
Yeah, sometimes they'll do a little, a very little brief intro to explain why there's a name change. But I've noticed a lot of times they don't. That guys will start as a prelim guy. You know, I know Sylvester Ritter, the future Junkyard Dog, had about a two-month run for McGurk, just doing prelims and not getting much of a push. And then a couple of years later, he's the Junkyard Dog. They didn't acknowledge that he had been there previously under a different name. They just treated him as a complete newcomer to the territory. And, well, you know, what's interesting, a lot of people don't realize when Junkyard Dog first came to, wasn't quite Mid-South at the time. It was about to switch over to Mid-South, but it was still McGurk and Watts' territory. He was a heel at first, and he was teaming with Porkchop Cash, and they were managed by Ernie Ladd. They were associated with Ernie Ladd, and they're feuding with Babyface's Charlie Cook and Hercules Ayala. And then JYD goes into a team with Gino Hernandez, and they call themselves Beauty and the Beast. And it was sort of a running joke where JYD thought he was the beauty of the team as opposed to Gino.
Right.
But it ends up with them splitting up. And then, of course, when the Freebirds attack Buck Robley, out of nowhere, Junkyard Dog came in for the save. And, of course, the rest is history. But a lot of times they don't acknowledge guys having been there previously under a different name. So that might have been the case with Keith. Or they might have just said, you know what? Now that I'm an Adonis, I've decided to change my name to Adrian Adonis.
Yeah, I don't recall him saying anything about any prior names. So, you know, it's just one of those things that happen.
And that's what sometimes makes it hard to chart these territories, is that you have guys that are different names, or you have so many guys under masks as the medics or the interns trying to figure out exactly which version of the medics was in a certain territory in a certain year is sometimes difficult. And hopefully my project and my site and my podcast and my books, Charting the Territories, are going to help answer some of those questions. And I, like I said, I want to create a baseball card stats. You can look at a baseball card and know, okay, this player in 1974, he was with this team and he had this batting average and this many home runs. Then the following year, he went to another team and he stayed with them for 3 years and then he went somewhere else. I would love to do something the same with wrestlers, and particularly the guys in the middle of the cards, your Adrian Adonis's, your Ron Stars. You say, okay, this year they were in this territory and this is how they were used and this is who they feuded with. And then the next year they went to a different territory and they feuded with this guy.
So as you were looking and charting this territory, what were your impressions? What are your thoughts?
I like I said, the biggest surprise is for me when I do a territory that I'm only somewhat familiar with is seeing the names that pop up lower in the cards. We mentioned Lanny Poffo. We mentioned Salvatore Bellomo, Tully Blanchard, King Parsons. These are guys, and they didn't have long runs in Portland, but these were guys that really aren't associated with Portland. But so many guys, just spent 6 months in one place and 3 months in another and kept traveling around, that you really can't associate them with one place. You really want to chart their entire progression. Of course, the top of the card was exactly what I expected. Rose, Piper, Brooks, the Sheep Herders, and Martell. So just seeing how long some of the guys were here, how frequently they do title changes or they do turns in this territory. There were a couple of other turns aside from Piper. Sam Oliver Bass came in as a babyface in October, but by the end of the year, it looks like he turned on probably Piper and maybe some of the other babyfaces, and he's working as a heel, and he's with Buddy Rose's army. And then at some point, Johnny Mantell is here as a mid-carder, and he's wrestling against babyfaces and teaming with heels for a few months. And then all of a sudden, it sort of switches, and he seems to be teaming up with babyfaces. So I don't know if they did a turn with Johnny Mantell or they just decided to book him a little differently. Do you have any recollection?
They did do a turn. Yeah, I have had Johnny on the show talking about all of that. One of the funny stories Johnny told is in Eastern Oregon, there's a place called Pendleton, and they wrestled there. And Piper would get guys to pool money together to fly over to Pendleton and back. Who would have guessed Portland used a plane?
Wow. Huh, I had no idea. I always thought that, well, you know, the towns they ran regularly are all along I-5.
You could be home every night.
Yeah, but every now and then they've got to venture further, you know, into the eastern part of the states, I guess. And every now and then they maybe even ran, you know, shows along the Idaho border. So at some point, you know, if you get enough people together to get a small plane, it might be less expensive than a few different carloads going around. And of course, it probably takes less time. But you mentioned Johnny Mantell. One of the interesting things about his career, early in his career, he worked for McGurk. And of course, Ken Mantell, his brother, had a big run there as a junior heavyweight champion. And I guess when Johnny was first starting out, they didn't want to acknowledge that he was Ken's brother. So he used the name Johnny Boyd.
Oh, that's funny.
And in fact, at one point, some of the major online results aggregator sites had listed that as Jonathan Boyd. But I actually spoke with Gil Culkin, and we got some pictures from programs, and it absolutely was Johnny Mantell, just using a different name when he was first starting. Because I guess maybe he was worried that if he didn't do really well, that it might, you know, reflect poorly on his brother Ken.
You know, people use the phrase these days, Piper in Portland. And he was red hot at this time. But you also think about Portland was never considered a major territory. But here we are listing off all the talent that came through Portland. Roddy Piper, Adrian Adonis, Gino Hernandez came through, Tully Blanchard, Iceman Parsons, you know, so many different, Rick Martel came through, so many different people, and it was not considered, you know, Luke, Killer Brooks, and not considered a major territory.
It's a great place for a wrestler on the way up to what I call level up.
Yeah.
You know, so many wrestlers, when they first start, they're usually working in various territories, just doing prelims, you know, trading wins back and forth with other prelim wrestlers, some of whom are rookies, some of whom are veterans, so they're learning from that. But as they, you know, as they start to get good, the promoters will sometimes send them off to somewhere else to try and, you know, find their footing. And oftentimes going to a smaller territory allows you the opportunity to do more. You might be able to get a stronger push. They might give you the opportunity. They might give you the ball and see what you can do with it. And you know, this might be the case with someone like Rip Rogers. Portland might have decided, this guy looks great, let's give him an opportunity and see what he can do with it. And maybe, just maybe, as he's going to other territories, his work doesn't improve. Because usually you improve as a wrestler by being in the ring with wrestlers who are better than you. That's the only way you're going to learn. And so when you come to Portland and you have the chance to work with guys like Dutch Savage, Stan Stasiak, and Buddy Rose, solid veterans who have been everywhere and seen everything, if you don't improve, then you've hit your ceiling. But if you do improve, and look at someone like Rick Martel, who clearly excelled in Portland, and it was the springboard for him to become a world champion for one of the biggest territories in the U.S., the AWA.
You know, you look at Piper, if you see, there's a little bit of footage from California. And if you compare the footage from California to Piper in Portland, you can see the growth and you can see the difference between a guy who's just learning and getting his first shot at the main event in a dying territory versus a guy who's drawing big money for Don Owen and ready to go on to Mid-Atlantic, go on to Georgia, and go on to the main event of the first WrestleMania. I mean, Piper came in and, you know, filled up the whole space. So, it's like a finishing school.
Yeah, that's a great way of naming it. Portland is the finishing school for professional wrestlers. As Frank Sinatra once said, you know, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. But yeah, they would give guys that were stuck in prelims and other places, like in Rip Rogers is a great example of that. They'll give them the ball, and then it's up to the wrestler what they do with it. And clearly Piper scored a touchdown, and maybe Rip didn't, and maybe that's why Rip sort of, hit the ceiling at that point. And, you know, obviously Tully, he's only here for 5 weeks, so you can't get a good feel for him, but that's how you get better, because if you stay in the same territory for too long, you're not going to get to work against a variety of people. You're going to work against the same guys. You're going to work the same style. Every territory has its own unique sort of style based on, you know, the demographics of you know, where they're at, what the fans are into, what's been established there. So you learn how to work different styles. You work with a variety of people. So many guys on the way up work both as heels and baby faces. And of course, one of the great ways to get someone to move up the cards is to team them up with a veteran, put them in a regular tag team. McGurk's territory, a lot of times they would do that with the rookies. They would team them up with a veteran like Danny Hodge. There was a guy that came around in the mid-70s named Jay Clayton, and they teamed him up with Hodge, and that's a great way to learn. I know for me, when I worked in the indies, as a manager, when they put me with someone, you know, who was very experienced, I learned more from doing a match with, you know, those guys than when I was working, managing the guys that I had known for years and had worked with a lot. But when a new name would come in, someone like a Buddy Landell, you know, someone that had been a star, just one match with them, just during the match itself, I would learn so much. And the most important lesson I learned in professional wrestling came from Brian Hildebrand, who a lot of people remember as referee Mark Curtis from WCW, passed away, sadly, years ago due to cancer. But he taught me the most important lesson I ever learned. And it wasn't about what to do or what not to do, but the lesson he taught me was when not to do the things that a heel manager does. Because me as a young heel manager, my goal was to be as loud, as obnoxious as possible, as often as possible. And it was Brian that taught me there are times when you need to shut up and don't have anyone paying attention to you, put the emphasis on what's going on in the ring, or have them forget about you so that when you do a heel spot, they're even madder because they didn't see it coming. And when I learned that, it was like a light bulb. So for someone to go to a finishing school in Portland and be able to learn from Buddy Rose or Dutch Savage or Stan Stasiak, even some of the veterans that work lower on the cards, like at this point, Tony Bourne is, you know, easing his way towards retirement. But Tony Bourne or Dr. Hiro Oda, who at this point had been wrestling for like 15 years, or Kurt Von Steiger, guys like that, you can learn so much from a 10-minute match with them that will get you to move up and to improve your game.
Al, this has been a lot of fun. Check out his book. It's called Charting the Territories. Presents the 1971-1973 Leroy McGurk, Oklahoma, Louisiana Wrestling Almanac. If you want to dive into that the way we dove into Portland, where can people find your book?
It's available on Amazon, and I know that's a long title, so I assure you, if you just go to Amazon and search for Charting the Territories Al Getz, it'll come up. You can also go to chartingtheterritories.com, and if you live in the continental U.S., you can order the book directly from me via PayPal, and I'll autograph the thing, and I'll throw in a picture, not of me, but of one of the wrestlers that worked for McGurk's territory at the time. And I'll give you a little info on how you get a discount on a future book order. But yeah, like you said, what we've done here, we've just sort of run down the roster by category. Who were the main eventers? Who were the upper mid-carders? So on and so forth. What were the top feuds? We do that for McGurk's territory in the book, but I also have listings for every known house show in Leroy's territory from 1971 to 1973. For a three-year period of time, I have 2,499 house shows, which gives you an idea of how big the territory was and how often they ran. They're typically running three shows a night, six nights a week.
That's a massive enterprise.
It really is. Even a small territory like Portland, there are times where they're running two shows with a split crew. They'll run small towns in Oregon, and maybe Dutch is running one and Owen's running the other. And they'll, especially when they have the minis, the little persons in, or maybe a couple of women wrestlers, that increases the size of the crew enough that they can split it up into two separate shows.
Al Getz, man, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Jim. I had a great time talking with you. This was fantastic.
I want to thank Al Getz. I really enjoyed that. I hope we get to do that again very soon. Be sure to go to chartingtheterritories.com. I'm Jim Valley. This has been the Portland WrestleCast. And as Lonnie Main says, there's excitement in the air.
So long, everybody. From the Portland Sports Arena, this has been Portland Wrestling.